Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
I'm Giselle Green. I'm the editor of Constructive Voices at NCVO. That's the National Council for Voluntary Organisations. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here today to this RSA event. Let me introduce you to our panel, who are going to be talking about the current news climate and its effect on many aspects of our lives, and also looking at how constructive journalism could create a better news experience for all of us in all sorts of ways, personal empowerment, our mental health, our public dialogue, and to ensure we get a more balanced view of our world. So, over here we have Jodie Jackson, who is a research associate at the Constructive Journalism Project. And Jodie is the author of an upcoming book, which we have a copy here, have just been given, hot off the press, You Are What You Read, Why Changing Your Media Diet Can Change the World. It'll be out at the beginning of April. Next to her is Sir Martin Lewis, who I'm sure you will recognise, a former television journalist, the face of ITV and BBC News for many of us growing up, and now heavily involved with the voluntary sector. This is Emily Kasril, an award-winning journalist, head of editorial partnerships at BBC World Service, and she leads on the BBC Solutions Journalism project. And next to me is Sean Dagan-Wood, who publishes Positive News magazine. Hopefully complimentary copies will be available after the event, subject to the courier arriving. He also co-founded the Constructive Journalism Project. Now, in a moment, I'm going to be asking each of the panelists to give us their thoughts for around 5 minutes. Then we'll be having a bit of a discussion. Then I'll open it out to you, the audience. So please think of questions as we're going along. And then we will hopefully wrap up by 2 o'clock. So quite a lot to pack in. So before I hand over to the panel, I've got a couple of questions for you, the audience. So I just wanted a show of hands. Who this morning read a paper, listened to some news on the TV or radio? Okay, that's like more or less everyone. Okay, looking at it from the other way, have any of you ever found yourself actively avoiding news and not wanting to listen to the news? So, okay, that's probably around half or a bit more even. So, well, you are in good company. Some recent surveys out, one in particular by the Edelman, they have something called a Global Trust Barometer, showed that a fifth of people say they're avoiding news completely. A third say they consume less news than they used to. And another survey by the Reuters Institute for Journalism showed that a quarter of people in UK are actively avoiding news often or sometimes. So, which brings us on neatly to our first guest, Jodie. You were one of those news consumers who found yourself tuning out, but you didn't just switch off. You decided to take matters into your own hands and embarked on a journey which has seen you now writing this book. Can you tell us a bit about what prompted this and what you did?
Well, I came into the conversation about constructive journalism from the perspective of the consumer. And as Giselle rightly said, I gradually moved from being someone who watched and listened to the news daily to someone who could actually no longer stand it. And the reason that I got to this point was because I found it so negative. I became so disheartened about the state of the world and really quite disappointed in humanity. But what I quickly realized when I paid a bit more attention to this is that the news is not an accurate reflection of the world. It reflects some parts of the world, the problems, the failings, the disasters, and it magnifies them. And at the same time, it minimizes stories of progress, development, and solutions. And this gives us quite a distorted picture of the world. And we're left with the impression that the world, it's broken beyond repair and that it's in a rapid state of decline. And a very memorable moment that I had that reflected this was when I was sitting with my mother-in-law, Eva, after I just had my first child. And she said to me in such a disappointing tone that she worried about the future for my little girl and the world that she was going to have to grow up in. Because she thought that it was so much more dangerous today than it was when she was young. And you have to bear in mind with this that Eva was born into a world war in 1945, yet she believes the world is a more dangerous place today. And she's not alone in this kind of thinking. An astonishing 71% of Britons believe that the world is getting worse. But actually, statistically speaking, since 1945, and we're talking globally here, we're more prosperous, we have better health, better technology, better sanitation, we have higher IQs, less child mortality, less deaths from conflict, fewer homicides, and have seen a reduction in overall crime figures. So with all this progress, why is it that people think that the world is moving backwards? And what effect is this kind of inaccurate and dismal thinking having on our mental health? And what can we do to take more control of it? And it was all of these questions that led me to go back to university to do a master's in positive psychology. I dived headfirst into as much media research as I could find over the last century to understand the effects of the negativity bias. And then I created my own research to learn from those who included solutions-focused news into their media diet, and I studied the effects that they felt that it had on them. And all of this is documented in my new book, You Are What You Read. But what the evidence showed is that the negative imbalance over a long period of time can have harmful effects on our mental health. We develop things like anxiety, depression, a feeling of helplessness. We become desensitized to the information that we're being given, and so we care less about these people that are affected by these problems and the tragedies that we're facing. But we can also care less about people because it really fires up this feeling of contempt and hostility towards other people. And finally, we may switch off from the news altogether because we can't cope with these feelings or we choose to avoid them. And that's a real problem. So then I wanted to find out what happens when people include solutions into their media diet. And when I say solutions-focused news, we're not talking about light-hearted, uplifting, entertaining puff pieces. We're talking about rigorous journalism that reports critically on tangible progress being made in order for us to understand how these issues are being dealt with. So we do still learn about the problems, but we also learn about how these problems are being resolved, what solutions are being put in place, and question if they're actually working. And I found that by having this healthy balance between problems and solutions, it provides context and helps paint a much more accurate picture of the world. And this reduces anxiety, it increases engagement, it improves our mood in the short term and actually shifts our mindset in the long term. It improves social cohesion. It leads to active coping, where we actually engage with these problems rather than avoid them. And this is primarily because it increases our feelings of hope, optimism, and self-empowerment. Sometimes you do need to see it to believe it. And witnessing others overcoming adversity and achieving progress in the presence of problems can give you the necessary belief in your own potential to overcome challenges and make a constructive difference in the world. I've summarized that incredibly briefly. So when we look at these responses, it might seem as if I'm saying reading problems-focused news is bad for us and reading solutions-focused news is good for us, but it's definitely not that simple. There's no denying that reporting on problems and failures is a good thing and has allowed society to progress. But we have too much of it. And this excess has moved it from becoming helpful to actually becoming quite harmful. And when I realized this, I found that it wasn't about switching off from the news altogether, but it was about consuming it in a different way, in a more constructive and balanced way. So my new book, You Are What You Read, explains all of this in much more detail, and it invites all consumers to have a much more constructive approach to their information diet.
Thank you, Jodie. Now, Sir Martin, you spoke out against the negative bias of news over a quarter of a century ago, and in a lovely circle of history, you actually gave a speech about that right here at the RSA. We'll talk a bit later about what's changed since then, but can you take us back to 1993 and why you made what was seen at the time as a very controversial speech, and you were labelled as a good news junkie?
Absolutely, and it involved a huge amount of distortion of my argument, because one of the things about journalism, certain types of journalist, is that they will often distort an argument in order for it to present a better target for attack. And that's exactly what they did with me. They pretended I'd said some things I hadn't said, because all I was arguing was that when we come to judge the priorities for each day's news, we should be more prepared than we've been in the past to judge the positive things that are happening in society, in a properly critical journalistic way, as Jody says, alongside the negative things. And it shouldn't be dominated by everything that is going wrong, because there are some great things that are going right. And what really gave me the focus for my speech, because I've been thinking this for some time, was in 1991, I bumped into Simon Jenkins, who was then editing The Times, at a reception. And Simon came up to me and he said, do you know, he said, I was presenting the 9 o'clock news at the time, and Simon came up to me and he said, I'm afraid I switched your bulletin off after the fourth story last night. And I said, why did you do that? He said, the body count was too high. And in other words, there were four totally different types of stories. All of them involved, you know, either shots of coffins or of a massive death toll in this war or another, or some court case that was going through the Old Bailey, and it was all about bodies. So that set me thinking. And then about 2 years later, I was when I'd been talking about the need for more balanced news in various private forums, I was asked by the Colorado School of Journalism if I would go and deliver their annual lecture. And I thought, what can I write about? And I thought, well, why don't I tackle this? Because it's something that's been undercover, it's been under the carpet. You know, the journalists didn't really want to talk about it. So I pulled a speech together and I showed it to the BBC before I went out to the United States, because I was under contract to them. And they called me in when they'd seen the speech, and they said, you can't make this speech under any circumstances. And I said, why? They said, well, you finger BBC programs, you know, as having made what you consider to be the wrong choices. And they said, you know, we think the tabloid press would have a field day with this. And I said, but that should not be the basis on which you make a judgment. You should make a judgment on whether this is an argument that deserves airing. So anyway, about three or four days before I left for America, I finished doing the 9 o'clock news every evening and spent 2 hours with the head of public relations for BBC News, going through my speech and changing it so that I removed all the references to the BBC and replaced it with one international broadcaster I know and phrases like that, you know. And it was, so anyway, I'm on the plane to Los Angeles. Everything is all go for the speech. I step off the plane, because I was making a version of the speech first to a town hall meeting in LA, and before I went to Atlanta, and to Colorado rather. And then as I stepped off the plane, I was handed a note, said, call the BBC immediately. So I called the BBC and they said, Tony Hall has seen your speech. He was then head of news. And whether this was him speaking or not, I'm not sure. Possibly his master's voice, John Burt, but who knows. He said, Tony has seen your speech and says you must not make that speech under any circumstances. So I said, look, I'm not going to take a decision. I just stepped off the plane from LA, 11-hour flight. I said, I'm going to sleep on it, and I'll call you back when I wake up. So I woke up, and there was a message from my agent to say that the head of contracts at the BBC had said that my job was absolutely on the line if I went ahead and made this speech, and that I would be fired. And can I tell you, I saw red. I saw red because here was an organization that is a bastion of democratic debate and argument that analyzes and reports on every other sector of society. And here they were, not prepared to entertain an argument about what they did and how they did it, about the principles of journalistic reporting. So I had a discussion with my wife, and I said, look, we got the mortgage and the house and everything. And she said, go ahead and do it if you want to. So I went ahead, made the speech, and then went on to Colorado to make the speech in Colorado. In between, being interviewed by CNN, and my interview led CNN bulletins across the United States for the whole of the day. The BBC rang about 4 hours after the first interview had gone out and said, we've heard you that you're going to talk to CNN, you mustn't talk to them under any circumstances. I said, too late, it's actually gone, it's happened. Why they thought they still had any say over my life at that point, because as far as I'm concerned, I'd made the speech and I was fired. And then I got a call from, my agent got a call from Newsnight to say, would you come on Newsnight, go into the studio, in a studio in America? And I said, yes, of course. 4 hours later, she got another call to say that Newsnight had been ordered not to interview you, to cancel the interview. And I thought, hang on a second, you know, this is all going completely crazy. So I was, the Independent newspaper, I'd given them a copy of the speech beforehand, and the Independent published a full-page version of the speech, which, of course, the BBC couldn't do anything about. So that started the ball rolling, and then a huge number of newspapers picked it up. It became a controversial, very controversial argument for the whole of that week. And I'd planned to go on holiday with some friends in Florida after I'd made the speech, which I did. And I came back thinking I didn't have a job to come back to. On my fax machine, remember those machines? On my fax machine was a message from the number two or number three guy in BBC News saying, feelings are running high in the newsroom. Come in and see me before you go into work. So I thought, this is it, I'm going to be fired. So I walked in to see him, and he and the head of PR for BBC News, they rose as one when I came in, and they said, Martin, how are you? Good to see you. Did you have a nice holiday? And I thought, hang on a second, what's going on here? Because in those days, I'm sure it isn't now, but in those days, BBC management blew with the wind. And it was just the latest opinion. And they'd had loads of letters at chairman level, at director general level, in support of what I had said. That was it. I walked into the newsroom. Feelings were running high. 90% of the newsroom had actually read my whole speech and agreed with me. That's how high they were. But so, anyway, that was what happened then. A lot has happened since. And I could not be more delighted with the way that positive news or solutions-focused journalism, as the BBC calls it, is now moving. And I like to think that, I met Tony Hall the other day at a reception. I said, Tony, I see you're introducing solutions-focused journalism. He said, oh, yes, wasn't that something you talked about 25 years, 25 years ago? I said, I'm so delighted. But 25 years ago, and I think it shows that although BBC decision-making processes can be rather slow at times, they eventually get there.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Martin. Thank you. Okay, well, that obviously leads perfectly on to Emily, who is now the prime mover behind solutions-focused journalism at the BBC. Can you sort of tell us a bit about why you personally felt it was important for the BBC and how you went about incorporating it?
Well, thank you very much. I should say, if we were as good and had made as much progress as you say, Martin, I wouldn't have any need to do what I'm doing inside the BBC. So it's an ongoing. But for me personally, one thing that happened when I was reflecting back on it is that years ago I was reporting for the BBC in Nigeria, and it was my first assignment for the BBC, and it was at a time when Nigeria was a lot of violence and the military was in charge, and I was covering an election. So I went there with a local journalist, it was in Lagos, and we went to a polling booth. And it was really peaceful, and everybody was, in very peaceful queues and exercising their right and putting their papers into the ballot. And I said to the guy with me, I said, listen, there's no story here, but please go and find something that I can really report on. Didn't press my tape recorder at all, went straight to find some action. And when I was reflecting on it later, it made me realise so much of what we consider to be news is looking often for the negative outlier. And it made me realise that what about the possibility that we can look for the positive outlier and understand it better? So after going on various courses and discussing with various people inside news and with a head of news, since then I've been leading an initiative within news. And as you were saying, accuracy and impartiality are absolutely at the core of what we do. So rather bizarrely, we're not looking for impact in terms of making the world a better place in news, aside from informing people better. And so we want to inform people as well as we can. But as part of that, we need to be telling them an accurate story of reality. And surprise, surprise, that includes solutions as well as focusing on problems. So it's interesting the kind of moves within the BBC that have made my job easier and a part of, I think, the sort of story coming from what you were doing, Martin. And one of them is the enormous importance of the African audience to the BBC World Service, which is a stable where I come from. So every week we reach more than 1 million Africans on TV, radio, online, digital, social. And we find in the research that we've done, particularly amongst younger people, that the developing world is a lot more keen to hear about solutions, interestingly, than the developed world. And it's part of challenging the narrative in Africa of Africa as a problematic area. And Africans want to hear about what Africans are doing to make the world better and to make Africa and African countries, because, of course, there's massive diversity in Africa. That's been really important. And the other thing that's been very helpful in terms of my work is the growing importance of our younger audience to the BBC. I'm sure many of you have read about the challenge that the BBC has in reaching younger audiences, because competition from Netflix, from YouTube, from all sorts of other things that they're doing with their time mean that they're not coming in to watch, consume, read, watch videos in the numbers that they did in the past. And so it's an enormous priority for the BBC to reach this audience. And this audience is really so much research, both anecdotal and also, more quantitative, has talked about younger people wanting to hear more about solutions. Now, because of the sort of BBC news brand, the way that I've been thinking through the solution-focused journalism work is, for starters, we're not calling it positive news, and we're not even calling it constructive news. We are just calling it solution-focused journalism because we are choosing to focus on solutions as well as focusing on problems. And so the way that we do solution-focused journalism is, you first of all want to find and establish a problem. And then you want to find a solution. And what's really, really critical in doing good solution-focused journalism work is the how. It's a real nitty-gritty. How is this problem being solved? And how does the solution work? And the reason this how is important is that other people who are maybe dealing with the same issue, lack of water or climate change or whatever, air pollution, whatever story we're talking about, can take tips because they're actually seeing how people are tackling. The other critical thing is looking for evidence. And this is challenging sometimes in solution-focused journalism, because if a solution has been around for a very long time, it doesn't feel very newsy. And if it's a new solution, it might not yet have proper randomised controlled trials. But we need to be open with our audience and tell them how much, what the evidence is, or if it's too early stage. Then the next critical thing really is looking at limitations. As you said, solution-focused journalism isn't about puff pieces. Just think about the coverage of Kids Company, including by the BBC, which was far from ideal, wasn't rigorous, and it didn't look at limitations, of which there were many about the Kids Company that we should have examined. So looking at limitations of any solution, the same rigorous questions that we ask as journalists when we cover any other news story. And the other thing is really important is asking the question, can this scale? So can this particular solution work only in a particular context? Let's say in London, kids' secondary school attainment has done very, very well. But is that because there's so many immigrants with aspirational parents? Or is it because of other factors which have influenced the type of teaching that's happening in London, which means that that could be replicated elsewhere? I mean, for me personally, when you ask, why are you in this space, one of the key things for me is agency. And I think it is so important not to just portray people as victims, particularly after a disaster. Because, surprise, surprise, when there's been a big earthquake or a volcano or a natural or a man-made disaster, most people pick up their, you know, their shoe straps and get on with it and find solutions and help each other. And by portraying them with their agency, not only is a more accurate picture of what happens, but also makes us, as consumers, not feel so hopeless, going back to some of the themes that you were talking about earlier, Jodie.
Thank you. Thank you, Emily. Sean, as publisher of Positive News, can you tell us what drew you into this whole area of constructive journalism and made you such a passionate advocate? And also, can you pick up on, Emily talked about Positive News, because your magazine is obviously called Positive News, but I know people might think it's just about happy news, which is obviously not at all what you're about. So can you just sort of talk a bit about that distinction? Sure.
Yes, so I think what attracted me to working in this space originally was my belief in the power of stories. I've always worked with words, and I came to recognise, I think first of all for myself, how the stories that I was telling myself about, this is when I was in my early 20s, when I started working in the industry, that the stories I was telling myself about what was possible for me in my life and what the world was like and what my future could look like were affecting how I felt and my everyday experience. And I think I was struggling, like I hear many people do, and many of our readers do at least, with trying to work out, is the world really a good place or not? Because, you know, there's all these stories in the news that creates this overall narrative that things are really bad and they're getting worse. And, you know, predominantly we should be afraid of other people. There's, you know, there's crime happening on every street. And obviously I'm completely oversimplifying, but there's a general sense of that narrative that comes across in the news. And I realised how I was internalising certain stories and how that affected me. And I thought, I don't want to experience my life like that. And actually, my everyday experience, you know, which I'm grateful for, is not that the world's like that. I know these things happen and they're there, and we need to, of course, give them our attention. But actually, life's much more complex and richer than that. And I felt like journalism was falling short. So for me, what excited me about working for Positive News was the opportunity to help create a different narrative, one that empowered people, because I'm a big believer in the human potential. I didn't want to not believe in the good of humanity and the potential of humanity. And then I came to realise that we could actually change that shared story that we have about how the world is if we started giving more attention to progress, to possibility and to solutions. So, you know, for me, understanding that stories are how we make sense of the world, and obviously, you know, in our conversations, we share, we talk about news stories a lot, and we establish this kind of framework for this kind of social consciousness of what our world is like. So although, you know, I understood it's essential to report on crime and exploitation and inequality, and crucially, you know, journalism always has been about holding power to account, and that's what we must continue doing. But I think journalism can do a lot more than that. So I'm really interested in how journalism can empower people. And, you know, learning from the developments, the findings of modern psychology, which Jodie refers to a lot, you know, we understand now that if we only focus on what's going wrong, even though the intention may be good, and, you know, especially in investigative journalism, obviously, there's really good public service going on there in terms of exposing problems. But if we become overwhelmed, we actually can end up disengaging. So really, I wanted to be part of something where we can help create that different narrative that's a fuller picture of the truth and that helps give people a perspective on the world which empowers them rather than leaves them feeling disconnected, potentially fearful of others and cynical. So for me personally, I found that working in this area of journalism really empowering for myself, because my worldview shifted when I started publishing these stories. And in terms of the name, I think it's interesting in that, you know, when at industry events and so on, we always have a lot of talk about, you know, what should we call it, and it's this new growing field, and of course we need that kind of academic approach to understanding and embedding in this new field. But what we hear from our audience is it doesn't actually matter that much to the public. It's very much, you know, an internal industry discussion where there is a lot of, I think, reservation, dare I say, fear of the word positive. Understandably, journalists have to be a bit cynical. You know, we have to question everything, which is great. And I think there's almost a fear of being seen to be advocating something or making out like everything's all right when it's not. And that's understandable. So I think that the key thing for me that needs to happen in the industry is a culture shift, because we can apply all the same tools of journalism, of good journalism, to reporting on progress and on solutions. We're still seeking truth. We're still being transparent. We're still seeking multiple sources. You know, we're still trying to find a compelling angle for the story. But for me, the big shift is the shift in mindset. And I think there's some assumptions in journalism at the moment which need to unravel that. And the core assumption really is that news is what's going wrong. So I once had a brief chat with a leading investigative journalist, and I said to him, what do you think about the idea of positive news? And he'd been reporting on the phone hacking scandal at the time. And he said, well, you know, a building falls down, that's news. But if a building's still there one day after it was there the next day, that's not news. And that showed me this mindset that the starting point isn't neutral. The starting point is looking for something going wrong. Whereas, you know, positive news isn't about the building that didn't fall down. It's about the brand new building that's completely sustainable and can feed a population better because it's got food grown on the roof and so on. You know, it's that shift in mindset and having the intention of how can I look at this story from a way where I can find information that's really going to serve people. And I think we now have to take that responsibility more seriously as journalists, not just getting as much information we can out there because we're overwhelmed with information, but it's like what information is really going to empower people.
Thank you, Siobhan. Now, a few of you have talked about empowerment and impact. Siobhan, can you just very briefly give us a bit of a flavour of any particular stories that Positive News has covered that you feel have had a huge impact and, you know, the way the audiences have responded to them?
Yeah, in fact, the ones that often make the most impact are the relatively small but very tangible and relevant stories where there's a lot of common sense. So, for example, one we ran recently about the first supermarket in London to have a whole area that was free of plastic packaging. People love that because it's like, yes, we just need to do this. Great. Or the lending library where you can rent things like lawnmowers and anything you need that not everyone needs to own. And it's, you know, it's really low cost. It's those kind of, I mean, you talked about looking at things that can scale, those kind of really common sense, tangible, positive things that could be replicated and then help shift the way things work
so
in society.
So people feel there's something they can actively do about it. Emily, what about at the BBC? How does solutions-focused journalism actually appear on our screens and our radios?
Well, we have a special solution-focused weekly show called World Hacks, which is on digital and podcast, and I don't know if any of you consume it. But I've also, I was talking to a friend of mine, actually runs a Persian service, and I was saying, you know, how can I really get people across the BBC engaged in this in BBC News? And she said to me, Emily, you've got to get them all to focus on one problem, and it's got to be air pollution. This was about 2 years ago, and I was like, oh. And then I looked into it, and I thought, fantastic. So we did a season 2 years ago now called So I Can Breathe. I don't know if anybody heard of that. And it was just full of different stories because of, you know, news gathering and the scale of the BBC from across the UK and across the world. And that had quite a big impact from British Lung Foundation, all sorts of MPs in different ways, which is great. And then last year, we did something called Crossing Divides, which is stories about people coming together across lines of race, class, religion, age, politics, for example. And that was a whole pilot in BBC News for a week. It had 45 stories, and it did really well with audiences. We had over 5 million page views of the stories on our own site, and on social media, 300,000 shares, comments, and likes. And in fact, we're going to be doing something very exciting, which I can't talk about yet, but we're going to announce next week in this space. So if you look at the BBC, and that's going to be on your screens and airwaves and TV and radio from the week of the 4th of March. So I feel by doing some of these big projects, it gets a lot more journalists to experience solution-focused journalism and to see, because it's quite difficult sometimes for them to make that mind shift, but by doing it, it, you know, increases their confidence so it can then infiltrate all sorts of parts of the organisation without forgetting our role to inform people and talk about a whole range of problems as well as solutions.
Thank you. In terms of sources for stories, Martin, I know you feel very strongly that charities and social enterprises are a very rich but underused resource or source of stories. And full disclosure here, Martin was behind the creation of the Constructive Voices project that I actually now run when he was chair of NCVO, which promotes constructive journalism and also flags up to journalists interesting stories about how problems are being tackled by the voluntary sector. But Martin, why did you feel so strongly about the need for,
well,
this area?
There are approximately 170,000 registered charities in this country and an estimated 130,000 to 150,000 non-registered organisations, which are just people getting together to deal with problems in their community. The vast majority of that, we hear about the big national charities, the vast majority of those organisations are locally based, and they are people who, in a way, are the finest example of democracy that you can find. They're the ultimate in democracy. We think of democracy as elections every 5 years to Parliament and so on. These are people on the ground, in communities right across the country, who identify an issue or problem, and it is probably between them the entire range of problems affecting society. And they are getting together with friends and neighbours to actually do something about it. And they're beavering away in a very low, often low-profile way, except, of course, when something goes wrong and they hit the headlines. But some of the work they are doing is quite phenomenal in terms of the lessons that it would provide for national politicians, because the work is, it's below the radar. And what you need is some of these stories that offer potential solutions to issues that may become national. Well, they're there in the early stages in the voluntary sector. And, you know, if you look at the reporting of the voluntary sector, I chair something called the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service, where we've, since 2002, we've given out about 3,000 awards to groups of individuals working at grassroots level in communities with a high degree of success. The stories, some of the stories are quite fantastic. Yet, have they had coverage in the national newspapers? No, they haven't. And yet, they are the very kind of interesting journalistic stories that people would sit up and say, wow, if someone says, wow, I didn't know that, that's really interesting, that is a story. And let me give you just two examples. An organization called Mac UK, founded in 2008, it is revolutionizing the way that mental health services are provided for excluded young people, okay? With particular success in providing therapy for young gang members. Talk about a story that is absolutely on the cusp of other things that are being reported on in society. And then there's an organized charity called AFRIL, Action for Refugees in Lewisham, which is one of the country's most deprived areas. It's a grassroots charity working with refugees and asylum seekers to relieve poverty and social isolation. It has got a phenomenal track record year after year in helping to build a really cohesive community. Now, isn't that the kind, isn't it a great story? Wouldn't it be great just to ask how? How are they doing that? Because when you write about a potential solution to a problem, you actually have to report on the problem itself. So the kind of journalism that I'm talking about, that we're talking about, it's a win-win for editors, because it actually means that if they want to have the negative headline, they can have it, but the reader, viewer, listener is not left with the feeling the world's going down the plug hole.
Thank you. Jodie, I wanted to pick up about, quite a few of you have talked about progress, and this difficulty that things that are, so progress happens very slowly, it's slow burning, there's not a particular moment when it happens, whereas traditional news tends to be very sort of fast and dramatic. Bill Gates, who is actually, he was the guest editor of Time magazine last year, and he wrote, "We've cut the number of people living in extreme poverty by half over the last 20 years, but there was never a morning when poverty rates drop incrementally dominated newspaper headlines." So how can we sort of overcome that sort of tension?
Well, I think one of the things that you picked up on very well is the kind of pace at which they both exist. So progress does happen a lot slower. And the kind of negative things that grab our attention, they can happen in an instant and they're immediately newsworthy in a different way. And so I think one of the things that I would recommend to consumers particularly is allowing themselves to slow down the conversation. There's a growing movement of slow journalism being developed at the moment. And it's so powerful in helping us understand issues better because it provides context, analysis, and takes a longer term perspective on an issue that actually helps us be able to understand the whole story a bit better than just the immediate impact of the problem itself. And it's really important that we manage both of those paces, because what happens otherwise is we have this gap between our perception of reality and reality itself. If we're leaving these stories, these slow-burning stories of progress off the news agenda, then we are given this impression that actually all of these problems, especially where the medium of news has changed, what was once available in just a daily dose, we now have available through social media channels, 24-hour news coverage, and online news organizations. I think the Washington Post in itself publishes 500 articles a day, and it's impossible. We're oversupplied and underinformed. So one of the ways to become better informed and help us develop that longer-term view would be to read from slow journalism news organizations as well, and one of which, Positive News, which covers both slow journalism and solutions-focused news, to help really guide us in having a much more accurate picture of the world. And the other thing, just while sort of through the panel on this point, we've been speaking about how rigorous reporting and on solutions can actually hold up a lot of the ideals of journalism. One of the biggest things that it can actually do is increase accountability. It can hold power to an account in a way that negative news reporting can't on its own. Whilst we're sort of told about failings and problems that particular organisations or government or people are sort of experiencing, when we're not given solutions and not shown about how it's working elsewhere, we kind of become apathetic and accepting of the fact that these problems are perhaps just too big to solve. But when you see people, like Martin said, these organizations at grassroots level tackling them themselves without big funding, without big resources, it really helps put pressure on these organizations who perhaps, or politicians or local council, who aren't tackling these same issues in their same communities by saying, well, look, there is progress taking place. It is working. We're just not allocating the time to be able to perhaps address it ourselves. And so I think all of that comes back together. And whilst we do become empowered by it, it's also a really important function of the press. And it's a really, really useful tool that's being underused at the moment to help hold power to account.
Isn't there a big elephant in the room here in that editors will use to justify their use of, going for the negative stories, that they'll say that people are clicking on negative stories, that's what audiences want, and yet we were also hearing it's bad for our mental health, so, like, what's going on here? I'd like to bring in at this point Professor Denise Baden from the University of Southampton, who has done a lot of research into this area. Is there a microphone that we can give to her? Thank you very much. And Denise, I hope you can talk a bit about the research that you've done. I think, you can just talk from there about the research that you've done into this and the implications for the decisions made by news editors.
Why don't we swap some stand up
on the cameras? Thanks, Sean. So I started off in this field by teaching business ethics, and we focused on scandals, and I realised I was kind of almost norming unethical behaviour, and people behave how they think it's normal to behave. So I was increasing cynicism, and I did some proper research and found out that cynicism was correlated with unethical behaviour. And so I thought, well, where else does this apply? So to go back to what Jodie was, you were talking about agency and so on. I tried it in the news sector. I exposed people to positive and negative stories, and those who exposed to positive stories showed a much higher inclination to say they would be more environmentally friendly, they would express their views, they would take action to make the world a better place, they would give to charity, much more likely than those with negative news. So I thought, this is something really, really important. So I went to talk to some news editors to see what their awareness was. So head of news at Reuters, BBC, Radio, Sky, Channel 4, Al Jazeera. And I found that positive news or constructive journalism or solutions, it was all propaganda. It was all puffery. It was girly. And there was an unspoken assumption that only negative news was news. It was completely unreflective. There was a real rebellion against the idea they were dancing to a commercial tune. I don't think any of the journalists or editors thought they were doing that, but they did cite that people click on negative news.
Why are they doing that?
And so there is sort of, I mean, you might have found this yourself if you're listening to sort of some 999 or alarmist program, that the air of alarm in someone's voice will make you stop and listen, even if you're not remotely interested. You can't help it. It's an evolutionary response to pay attention to alarming information, and you can see why that would be good. From an evolutionary perspective. But we didn't evolve in a society where we have 24-hour access to the worst of the world's problems, condensed and bigged up and magnified for effect and presented to our little brains. We did not evolve to deal with that. So it's an ethical issue, and I think it's a completely unacknowledged one.
So, can I just say that isn't there an argument? For a better balanced news structure, because all the evidence from the internet is that when you actually give people solutions stories or stories that involve solutions, they're much more likely to share those stories with others. And here's the commercial imperative. They're much more likely to go back to the organization that provided those stories in the hope that there will be more stories of that nature coming their way. And, you know, if you look at the way that audiences for not just television news, but newspapers as well, have been declining so rapidly over the last few years, you would think that at some point somebody would say, actually, these kind of stories could increase our readership. I mean, you know, I've never thought I'd say this, but there were three front pages on recruiting volunteers for hospitals in the Daily Mail recently. I've never known that any tabloid newspaper in Britain until that point devote a front page to a positive story about something that good in society, and now they're doing it with litter, with picking up their big campaign to pick up litter around the country.
I think you're absolutely right, especially as I was saying about younger people, and I think that's part of what's helping me make the case inside the BBC, just because of the, you know, it's two things. It's number one on the individual story, and it's number two on the whole brand, which is why it's important to include these stories too. So I absolutely agree.
And I think you're completely right. And the trouble is it's only people engaging with these sites whose views are being heard through their click behaviour. So there's a lot of people who wouldn't dream of engaging because they're put off in the first place. So I think there's room perhaps for some more research.
And actually, you know, the Harvard Business Review has produced a survey that says that if you consume a diet of negative news, you are less effective at work.
Well, right, positive news has saved my mental health.
Well, there we go.
Should I give this back to Sean?
Okay. I think it's probably high time that we open things out to the audience. So do you want to raise your hand and wait for the microphone if you've got a question to ask? Okay, there are a couple of people over there. And let us know if you want to address a particular panel member or open to everyone.
Yeah, hi, thank you. It's really picking up on something Martin said about grassroots organisations and how important they are and how more reporting of them could be really effective. It strikes me that one example of ways that that's been done is through local newspapers. Now, we know that local newspapers are in decline. A lot of them are closing down. They're facing real difficulties. It seems to me they have a real part to play in this. I guess I'd like to know what the panel thinks about that and if the decline of local newspapers should be just accepted and people are getting their news from other sources, or is there a role for local newspapers to play? If so, how can we revive them?
Well, thank you.
Well, I think the BBC and the government are already trying to take steps. They're both aware of the need to boost local newspapers. In the meantime, you've got what are called hyper-locals. There are local websites that have sprung up in areas where newspapers are in decline. And these are websites where they tend to be overwhelmingly about the good things that are happening in their community. And there's even the School of Journalism at Cardiff University now has a course on setting up hyperlocals that you can sign on to. So you know, newspapers, on the one hand, people are aware of the decline in local newspapers, trying to do more about it, but at the same time, they're encouraging people to set up these hyperlocals in opposition or competition to newspapers.
In addition to that as well, you know, there's a lot of pressure on news organisations to capture the audience, and, you know, especially where they're declining, what can they do, how can they change, how can they shift? But I think, and this is why mostly all of my work focuses on the consumer, is we have such a powerful role to play in helping news organisations survive, but we have to value the information and we have to understand how it's produced so that we can become more conscious as consumers to make choices that really do promote good quality journalism. And so that's for my book, You Are What You Read. Although there's a lot that can be taken from the industry, It's bringing this conversation to the consumer and inviting them to become a part of this kind of media revolution and laying the blame and the opportunity at their feet to say, actually, we're all a huge, important, untapped part of this, and how can we play a role in actually reviving and helping news industry, particularly good quality news industry, sustain.
Thank you.
Can I make a quick comment on that? So just briefly, I think, so there's the intersection here of the issues of negative and positive news and media business models. And of course, the media industry has been in crisis for a while. And what's really interesting where these issues cross over is I think there's a really good opportunity. So I hate to see journalists losing their jobs, and it's, you know, what's happening in local news, because news organisations are losing the advertising. So the profit-driven organisations that own these local news of companies, which there's fewer and fewer of, are cutting costs, and local news businesses are going out of business. But what's happening now is there's a more of a shift to understanding that we need to generate revenue from readers, which means that people are only going to pay for journalism that they trust and that's high quality. And we've known for a long time that people want more positive news stories. Audience researchers have told me this. I think the problem has been that the industry hasn't known how to do positive news properly or constructive or solution-focused journalism and understand that it's not the cat getting rescued from the tree. So we can really help local news at the same time as creating a more constructive journalism by, you know, as the public supporting news organisations that are trustworthy and that are genuinely trying to serve the public interest rather than the corporate profit interest. And that is starting to happen.
The gentleman in the white shirt
here. Thanks. I might be showing my age, but when I hear positive news, I think of Pravda and Tractor statistics. But it's no doubt a good thing. It isn't the point, though, that the real thing that's missing is, as you say, trust and balance. So to give you an example of what I mean, when I read a newspaper article, one of my favourite things when I read an opinion piece is to read the comments underneath, which usually tear completely to shreds the actual comment piece. So perhaps we need a bit like we have with food, some kind of rating or something that gives you an idea of the fact content and the balance, and, you know, something gives you a bit of a sense.
There's been talk about a sort of a kite mark.
There is NewsGuard. NewsGuard is an organisation who basically fact check thousands of different news organisations and stories. And I think they recently signed a deal with Microsoft. If you have a Microsoft browser, it kind of has a rating. I think the Daily Mail got 1 out of 5 recently as a kind of warning that the information you're going to be getting isn't actually that factually based. And they're working. They've just had a huge injection of funding. And they are trying to sort of, it was started by 2 journalists, actually, but they are trying to scale that out to actually be able to kind of have a fact-based rating on different news organisations, particularly on particular stories as well, so that you're aware, you know, how much trust to actually place in the information that you're getting. But it's, yeah, definitely would be of huge value.
Gentleman in the black and red check shirt.
Thank you for a very interesting panel. Sir Martin, you said you started 25 years ago with your speech and you got huge pushback from within the BBC. And now, of course, 25 years later, we're at a very different point with the BBC focusing on solutions-focused news, organisations like Positive News bringing up. What do the panel think has needed to happen to get us from 1991 to here? What has driven this change in the wider sector and this acceptance of positive solutions-focused, whatever you want to call it, news?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of people coming at it from different angles and people realizing that there comes a point where negativity gets so strong, particularly when there's a big running negative story, that people stop taking it. They can't take it anymore. So it's partly a reaction to that, but I'd like to think that that is only a relatively minor point, because in the interests of fairness, in reporting fairly what is happening in the world. We've seen these books by Steven Pinker and by Hans Rosling, you know, recently, which have, and as Jody said, you know, they've actually pointed out that the world is a much, much better place in all kinds of ways. Well, tell us how. Tell us how it is better. Tell us what is going right. And do that with an emphasis on stories that are journalistically responsible and interesting. So that when someone comes to you and says this fantastic thing is happening in the world, as a journalist, you should say, well, let's ask all the tough journalistic questions about that. And if we find that is right and it's a good story that will interest people, well, let's run with it.
Emily, as someone who's doing this at the BBC, have you come up against sort of barriers amongst colleagues at the BBC?
You talked earlier about the sort of propaganda question, and I remember head of one of the language services who came, in fact, he grew up in a communist state, and he was very sceptical about the solution. He said, look, this sounds exactly what, you know, when I was growing up and people tried to do. So what we're always saying, this isn't about that sort of my country is great. I had some people from all sorts of different countries really delighted with thinking that it would change coverage. It is about being rigorous. But to answer to your question about why, you know, there has been this change, and, you know, I was just reflecting as you were asking the question, and I think part of it is the more democratization of news. I think that where all of us, where we share, where we comment, there's less difference, less distinction between what people in organizations like me do and what users of media do, and the ability that we all have in these days to share, to comment, to produce our own media. And therefore, there's a more sophisticated understanding of what stories are, rather than a kind of us making stories which broadcast to you as consumers. And I think it's part of that democratization has become more sophisticated way of understanding what news is, just because we can all tell different sorts of stories. And picking up what you said, Sean, it's so important because through these stories we create meaning.
But sorry, just to make one further development of that particular point, it does seem to me that everybody now is becoming their own news editor. Because people are choosing through the medium of the internet, they are actually choosing the kind of stories that they're interested in reading about. Now, if that goes to its logical conclusion, you will have a huge narrowing of the interest that people have in what is going on in the world, because it'll just be, you know, I'm interested in the oil industry, cricket, and Strictly Come Dancing, and you'll get just those stories coming your way, and maybe, if you're lucky, you will pick up something else on the fringes. But it's therefore all the more important that in a responsible society, that in order to attract these people back to what they see as negative news, which is why they're choosing their own agendas, you actually create a way in which television news and radio news and newspapers can be attractive again. I think that it's that combination of positive and negative, which in the way that we've been describing in a constructive way that makes so much difference.
Okay, as today's news editor, I'm going to allow one more question from this lady here at the front.
I'm sorry, everyone. I'm going to bring up the B word. During the referendum, there was a distinct lack of positive discussion about the pros and cons, I think as a Remainer, there was very, very little about what the good things were about the EU from even the people who were promoting it, and obviously we heard a lot about all the terrible things, and still it's the same. And another thing I was just going to say is that sometimes with the journalism at the BBC and ITV and all the other organisations, they're frightened to cross-examine people, particularly when they've said something inaccurate, and particularly with Vox Pops, a lot of people say, this is what I think, and it may be completely inaccurate, and the interviewer doesn't say, well, what evidence do you have? And of course, that's the accuracy thing, and I think that's part of positive news as well.
Mm. I think we could probably spend a whole another hour just discussing that, so unless anyone's got anything they could say in literally a sentence.
But this is for the BBC, this is on behalf of the BBC, because the BBC has a very good fact-checking service. That whenever someone says
reality
something,
check,
it's
real.
Yes,
now,
yeah, it's terrific.
It's also
yes. Anyway, thank you for that. And I think, as I say, it is a bigger discussion that I would love to get into, but probably not for today. So I think we're going to have to wrap up around now. I just wanted to say how, I think we've heard today about how studies have shown how constructive journalism can make people feel better informed and more optimistic and empowered and engaged. I hope that you'll all leave here today feeling many of those things. And as Martin mentioned, studies have also shown that people are more likely to share stories that have got that stir positive feelings. So I hope that you will also share what you've learned and heard today with your colleagues and friends and family. If you want to read more, just go on to the RSA webpage site about this event and you'll find information about all of us with lots of links. I've written something called The Express Guide to Constructive Journalism, which you can spend a while looking through. And I just want to finally thank our panel, Jody, Martin, Emily and Sean, and all of you for coming today. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews and animations.